monogrammed pillowcase on the bed. His place was always set at the table, in case he returned from the dead without warning, as he tended to do in life. But in those solitary masses, they began to be aware that once again they were mistresses of their fate, after having renounced not only their family name, but their own identity, in exchange for a security that was no more than another of a bride's many illusions. They alone knew how tiresome was the man they loved to distraction, who perhaps loved them, but whom they had to continue nurturing until his last breath as if he were a child, suckling him, changing his soiled diapers, distracting him with a mother's tricks to ease his terror at going out each morning to face reality. And nevertheless, when they watched him leave the house, this man they themselves had urged to conquer the world, then they were the ones left with the terror that he would never return. That was their life. Love, if it existed, was something separate. Another life. In the restorative idleness of solitude, on the other hand, the widows discovered that the honorable way to live was at the body's bidding, eating only when one was hungry, loving without lies, sleeping without having to feign sleep in order to escape the indecency of official love, possessed at last of the right to an entire bed to themselves, where no one fought them for half of the sheet, half of the air they breathed, half of their night, until their bodies were satisfied with dreaming their own dreams, and they woke alone. In the dawns of his furtive hunting, Florentino Ariza would see them coming out of 5 o'clock mass, shrouded in black and with the raven of destiny on their shoulder. As soon as they spotted him in the light of dawn, they would cross the street to walk on the other side with their small, hesitant steps, the steps of a little bird, for just walking near a man might stain their honor. And yet he was convinced that a disconsolate widow, more than any other woman, might carry within her the seed of happiness. So many widows in his life, since the widow Nazareth, had made it possible for him to discern how happy they were after the death of their husbands. What had been only a dream until then was changed, thanks to them, into a possibility that he could seize with both hands. He saw no reason why Fermina Daza should not be a widow like them, prepared by life to accept him just as he was, without fantasies of guilt because of her dead husband, resolved to discover with him the other happiness of being happy twice, with one love for everyday use which would become more and more a miracle of being alive, and the other love that belonged to her alone, the love immunized by death against all contagion. Perhaps he would not have been as enthusiastic if he had even suspected how far Fermina Daza was from those illusory calculations, at a time when she was just beginning to perceive the horizon of a world in which everything was foreseen except adversity. In those days, being rich had many advantages, and many disadvantages as well, of course, but half the world longed for it as the most probable way to live forever. Fermina Daza had rejected Florentino Ariza in a lightning flash of maturity, which she paid for immediately with a crisis of pity. But she never doubted that her decision had been correct. At the time, she could not explain what hidden impulses of her reason had allowed her that clairvoyance, but many years later, on the eve of old age, she uncovered them suddenly and without knowing how during a casual conversation about Florentino Ariza. Everyone knew that he was heir apparent to the River Company of the Caribbean during its greatest period. They were all sure they had seen him many times and had even had dealings with him, but no one could remember what he was like. It was then that Fermina Daza experienced the revelation of the unconscious motives that had kept her from loving him. She said, "It is as if he were not a person, but only a shadow." That is what he was. The shadow of someone whom no one had ever known. But while she resisted the siege of Dr. Juvenal Urbino, who was just the opposite, she felt herself tormented by the phantom of guilt, the only emotion she could not bear. When she felt it coming on, A kind of panic overtook her, which she could control only if she found someone to soothe her conscience. Ever since she was a little girl, when a plate broke in the kitchen, when someone fell, when she herself caught her finger in the door, she would turn in dismay to the nearest adult and make her accusation. It was your fault. Although in reality she was not concerned with who was responsible or with convincing herself of her own innocence, she was satisfied at having established it. The specter was so notorious that Dr. Urbino realized how much it threatened the harmony of his home, and as soon as he detected it, he hastened to tell his wife, "Don't worry, my love. It was my fault." For he feared nothing so much as his wife's sudden categorical decisions, and he was convinced that they always originated in a feeling of guilt. The confusion caused by her rejection of Florentino Arisa, however, had not been resolved with comforting words. For several months, Fermina Daza continued to open up the balcony in the morning, and she always missed the solitary phantom watching her from the deserted little park. She saw the tree that had been his, the most obscure bench where he would sit to read as he thought about her, suffered for her. And she would have to close the window again, sighing, "Poor man." When it was already too late to make up for the past, she even suffered the disillusionment of knowing that he was not as tenacious as she had supposed, and from time to time she would still feel a belated longing for a letter that never arrived. But when she had to face the decision of marrying Juvenal Urbino, she succumbed in a major crisis when she realized that she had no valid reasons for preferring him after she had rejected Florentino Arisa without valid reasons. In fact, she loved him as little as she had loved the other one, but knew much less about him, and his letters did not have the fervor of the other ones, nor had he given her so many moving proofs of his determination. The truth is that Juvenal Urbino's suit had never been undertaken in the name of love, and it was curious, to say the least, that a militant Catholic like him would offer her only worldly goods. Security, order, happiness, contiguous numbers that, once they were added together, might resemble love, almost be love. But they were not love. And these doubts increased her confusion, because she was also not convinced that love was really what she most needed to live. In any case, the principal factor operating against Dr. Juvenal Urbino was his more than suspect resemblance to the ideal man that Lorenzo Daza had so wanted for his daughter. It was impossible not to see him as the creature of a paternal plot, even if in reality he was not. But Fermina Daza became convinced that he was from the time she saw him come to her house for a second, unsolicited medical call. In the end, her conversations with Cousin Hildebranda only confused her. Because of Cousin Hildebranda's own situation as a victim, she tended to identify with Florentino Arisa, forgetting that perhaps Lorenzo Daza had arranged her visit so that she could use her influence in favor of Dr. Urbino. God alone knows what it cost Fermina Daza not to accompany her cousin when she went to meet Florentino Arisa in the telegraph office. She would have liked to see him again, to present him with her doubts, to speak with him alone, to learn to know him well, so that she could be certain that her impulsive decision would not precipitate her into another, more serious one. Capitulation in her personal war against her father. But that is what she did at a crucial moment in her life, giving no importance whatsoever to the handsomeness of her suitor, or his legendary wealth, or his youthful glory, or any of his numerous virtues. Rather, she was stunned by the fear of an opportunity slipping away, and by the imminence of her 21st birthday, which was her private time limit for surrendering to fate. That one moment was enough for her to make the decision that was foreseen in the laws of God and man: until death do you part. Then all her doubts vanished, and she could accomplish without remorse what reason indicated as the most decent thing to do. With no tears, she wiped away the memory of Florentino Arisa. She erased him completely, and in the space that he had occupied in her memory, she allowed a field of poppies to bloom. All that she permitted herself was one final sigh that was deeper than usual. Poor man. The most fearful doubts began, however, when she returned from her honeymoon. As soon as they opened the trunks, unpacked the furniture, and emptied the 11 chests she had brought in order to take possession as lady and mistress of the former palace of the Marquis de Casalduero, she realized with mortal vertigo that she was a prisoner in the wrong house, and even worse, with a man who was not. It took her 6 years to leave, the worst years of her life, when she was in despair because of the bitterness of Doña Blanca, her mother-in-law, and the mental lethargy of her sisters-in-law, who did not go to rot in a convent cell only because they already carried one inside themselves. Dr. Urbino, resigned to paying homage to his lineage, turned a deaf ear to her pleas, confident that the wisdom of God and his wife's infinite capacity to adapt would resolve the situation. He was pained by the deterioration of his mother, whose joy in living had at one time sparked the desire to live in even the most skeptical. It was true. That beautiful, intelligent woman with a human sensibility not at all common in her milieu had been the soul and body of her social paradise for almost 40 years. Widowhood had so embittered her that she did not seem the same person. It had made her flabby and sour and the enemy of the world. The only possible explanation for her decline was the rancor she felt because her husband had knowingly sacrificed himself for a black rabble, as she used to say, when the only fitting sacrifice would have been to survive for her sake. In any case, Fermina Daza's happy marriage lasted as long as the honeymoon, and the only person who could help her to prevent its final wreckage was paralyzed by terror in the presence of his mother's power. It was he, and not her imbecilic sisters-in-law and her half-mad mother-in-law, whom Fermina Daza blamed for the death trap that held her. She suspected too late that behind his professional authority and worldly charm, the man she had married was a hopeless weakling, a poor devil made bold by the social weight of his family names. She took refuge in her newborn son. She had felt him leave her body with a sensation of relief at freeing herself from something that did not belong to her. And she had been horrified at herself when she confirmed that she did not feel the slightest affection for that calf from her womb the midwife showed her in the raw, smeared with grease and blood and with the umbilical cord rolled around his neck. But in her loneliness in the palace, she learned to know him. They learned to know each other. And she discovered with great delight that one does not love one's children just because they are one's children, but because of the friendship formed while raising them. She came to despise anything and anyone who was not him in the house of her misfortune. She was depressed by the solitude, the cemetery garden, the squandering of time in the enormous windowless rooms. During the endless nights, she felt herself losing her mind as the madwomen screamed in the asylum next door. She was ashamed of their custom of setting the banquet table every day with embroidered tablecloths, silver service, and funereal candelabra so that 5 phantoms could dine on café con leche and crullers. She detested the rosary at dusk, the affected table etiquette, the constant criticism of the way she held her silverware, the way she walked in mystical strides like a woman of the streets, the way she dressed as if she were in the circus, and even the rustic way she treated her husband and nursed her child without covering her breast with her mantilla. When she issued her first invitations to 5 o'clock tea, with little imperial cakes and candied flowers in accordance with recent English fashion, Doña Blanca objected to serving remedies for sweating out a fever in her house instead of chocolate with aged cheese and rounded loaves of cassava bread. Not even dreams escaped her notice. One morning, when Fermina Daza said she had dreamed about a naked stranger who walked through the salons of the palace scattering fistfuls of ashes, Doña Blanca cut her off. "A decent woman cannot have that kind of dream." Along with the feeling of always being in someone else's house came two even greater misfortunes. One was the almost daily diet of eggplant in all its forms, which Doña Blanca refused to vary out of respect for her dead husband, and which Fermina Daza refused to eat. She had despised eggplants ever since she was a little girl, even before she had tasted them, because it always seemed to her that they were the color of poison. Only now she had to admit that in this case, something had changed for the better in her life. Because at the age of 5, she had said the same thing at the table, and her father had forced her to eat the entire casserole intended for 6 people. She thought she was going to die, first because she vomited pulverized eggplant, and then because of the cup full of castor oil she had to take as a cure for the punishment. Both things were confused in her memory as a single purgative, as much as for the taste as for her terror of the poison. And at the abominable lunches in the palace of the Marquis de Casalduero, she had to look away so as not to repay their kindness with the icy nausea of castor oil. The other misfortune was the harp. One day, very conscious of what she meant, Doña Blanca had said, "I do not believe in decent women who do not know how to play the piano." It was an order that even her son tried to dispute, for the best years of his childhood had been spent in the galley slavery of piano lessons, although as an adult he would be grateful for them. He could not imagine his wife, with her character, subjected to the same punishment at the age of 25. But the only concession he could wring from his mother, with the puerile argument that it was the instrument of the angels, was to substitute the harp for the piano. And so it was that they brought a magnificent harp from Vienna that seemed to be gold and sounded as if it were, and that was one of the most valued heirlooms in the museum of the city until it and all it contained were consumed in flames. Fermina Daza submitted to this deluxe prison sentence in an attempt to avoid catastrophe with one final sacrifice. She began to study with a teacher of teachers, whom they brought for that purpose from the city of Mompox, and who died unexpectedly 2 weeks later. And she continued for several years with the best musician at the seminary, whose gravedigger's breath distorted her arpeggios. She herself was surprised at her obedience, for although she did not admit it in her innermost thoughts, or in the silent arguments she had with her husband during the hours they had once devoted to love, she had been caught up more quickly than she had believed in the tangle of conventions and prejudices of her new world. At first, she had a ritual phrase that affirmed her freedom of thought. "To hell with a fan when the wind is blowing." But later, jealous of her carefully won privileges, fearful of embarrassment and scorn, she demonstrated her willingness to endure even humiliation in the hope that God would at last take pity on Doña Blanca, who never tired of begging him in her prayers to send her death. Dr. Urbino justified his own weakness with grave arguments, not even asking himself if they were in conflict with the church. He would not admit that the difficulties with his wife had their origin in the rarefied air of the house, but blamed them on the very nature of matrimony, an absurd invention that could exist only by the infinite grace of God. It was against all scientific reason for two people who hardly knew each other, with no ties at all between them, with different characters, different upbringings, and even different genders, to suddenly find themselves committed to living together, to sleeping in the same bed, to sharing two destinies that perhaps were fated to go in opposite directions. He would say, "The problem with marriage is that it ends every night after making love, and it must be rebuilt every morning before breakfast." And worst of all was theirs, arising out of two opposing classes in a city that still dreamed of the return of the viceroys. The only possible bond was something as improbable and fickle as love, if there was any. And in their case, there was none when they married, and when they were on the verge of inventing it, fate had done nothing more than confront them with reality. That was the condition of their lives during the period of the harp. They had left behind the delicious coincidences of her coming in while he was taking a bath, when, Despite the arguments and the poisonous eggplant, and despite his demented sisters and the mother who bore them, he still had enough love to ask her to soap him. She began to do it with the crumbs of love that still remained from Europe, and both allowed themselves to be betrayed by memories, softening without wanting to, desiring each other without saying so, and at last they would die of love on the floor, spattered with fragrant suds, as they heard the maids talking about them in the laundry room. If they don't have more children, it's because they don't fuck. From time to time, when they came home from a wild fiesta, the nostalgia, crouching behind the door, would knock them down with one blow of its paw. And then there would be a marvelous explosion in which everything was the way it used to be. And for 5 minutes, they were once again the uninhibited lovers of their honeymoon. But except for those rare occasions, one of them was always more tired than the other when it was time to go to bed. She would dawdle in the bathroom, rolling her cigarettes in perfumed paper, smoking alone, relapsing into her consolatory love as she did when she was young and free in her own house, mistress of her own body. She always had a headache, or it was too hot, always. Or she pretended to be asleep, or she had her period again. Her period, always her period. So much so that Dr. Urbino had dared to say in class, only for the relief of unburdening himself without confession, that after 10 years of marriage, women had their periods as often as 3 times a week. Misfortune piled on misfortune. And in the worst of those years, Fermina Daza had to face what was bound to come sooner or later. The truth of her father's fabulous and always mysterious dealings. The governor of the province made an appointment with Juvenal Urbino in his office to bring him up to date on the excesses of his father-in-law, which he summed up in a single sentence. There is no law, human or divine, that this man has not ignored. Some of his most serious schemes had been carried out in the shadow of his son-in-law's prestige, and it would have been difficult to believe that he and his wife knew nothing about them. Realizing that the only reputation to protect was his own, because it was the only one still standing, Dr. Juvenal Urbino intervened with all the weight of his prestige, and he succeeded in covering up the scandal with his word of honor. So that Lorenzo Daza left the country on the first boat, never to return. He went back to his native country as if it were one of those little trips one takes from time to time to ward off nostalgia. And at the bottom of that appearance, there was some truth. For a long time he had boarded ships from his country just to drink a glass of water from the cisterns filled with the rains of the village where he was born. He left without having his arm twisted, protesting his innocence, and still trying to convince his son-in-law that he had been the victim of a political conspiracy. He left crying for his girl, as he had called Fermina Daza since her marriage, crying for his grandson, for the land in which he had become rich and free and where, on the basis of his shady dealings, he had won the power to turn his daughter into an exquisite lady. He left old and sick, but still he lived much longer than any of his victims might have desired. Fermina Daza could not repress a sigh of relief when she received the news of his death, and in order to avoid questions, she did not wear mourning. But for several months, she wept with mute fury without knowing why when she locked herself in the bathroom to smoke. And it was because she was crying for him. The most absurd element in their situation was that they never seemed so happy in public as during those years of misery. For this was the time of their greatest victories over the subterranean hostility of a milieu that resisted accepting them as they were, different and modern. And for that reason, transgressors against the traditional order. That, however, had been the easy part for Fermina Daza. Life in the world, which had caused her so much uncertainty before she was familiar with it, was nothing more than a system of atavistic contracts, banal ceremonies, preordained words, with which people entertained each other in society in order not to commit murder. The dominant sign in that paradise of provincial frivolity was fear of the unknown. She had defined it in a simpler way. The problem in public life is learning to overcome terror. The problem in married life is learning to overcome boredom. She had made this sudden discovery with the clarity of a revelation when, trailing her endless bridal train behind her, she had entered the vast salon of the social club, where the air was thin with the mingled scent of so many flowers, the brilliance of the waltzes, the tumult of perspiring men and tremulous women who looked at her, not knowing how they were going to exorcise the dazzling menace that had come to them from the outside world. She had just turned 21, and had done little more than leave her house to go to school, but with one look around her, she understood that her adversaries were not convulsed with hatred, but paralyzed by fear. Instead of frightening them even more, as she was already doing, she had the compassion to help them learn to know her. They were no different from what she wanted them to be, just as in the case of cities, which did not seem better or worse to her, but only as she made them in her heart. Despite the perpetual rain, the sordid merchants, and the Homeric vulgarity of its carriage drivers, she would always remember Paris as the most beautiful city in the world. Not because of what it was or was not in reality, but because it was linked to the memory of her happiest years. Dr. Urbino, for his part, commanded respect with the same weapons that were used against him, except that his were wielded with more intelligence and with calculated solemnity. Nothing happened without them. Civic exhibitions, the poetic festival, artistic events, charity raffles, patriotic ceremonies, the first journey in a balloon. They were there for everything, and almost always from its inception, and at the forefront. During those unfortunate years, no one could have imagined anyone happier than they, or a marriage more harmonious than theirs. The house left by her father gave Fermina Daza a refuge from the asphyxiation of the family palace. As soon as she could escape from public view, she would go in secret to the Park of the Evangels, and there she would visit with new friends and some old ones from school or the painting classes. An innocent substitute for infidelity. She spent tranquil hours as a single mother, surrounded by what remained of her girlhood memories. She replaced the perfumed crows, found cats on the street, and placed them in the care of Galla Placidia, who by this time was old and somewhat slowed by rheumatism, but still willing to bring the house back to life. She opened the sewing room where Florentino Arisa saw her for the first time, where Dr. Juvenal Urbino had her stick out her tongue so that he could try to read her heart. And she turned it into a sanctuary of the past. One winter afternoon, she went to close the balcony because a heavy storm was threatening, and she saw Florentino Arisa on his bench under the almond trees in the little park, with his father's suit altered to fit him and his book open on his lap. But this time, she did not see him as she had seen him by accident on various occasions, but at the age at which he remained in her memory. She was afraid that the vision was an omen of death, and she was grief-stricken. She dared to tell herself that perhaps she would have been happier with him, alone with him in that house she had restored for him, with as much love as he had felt when he restored his house for her. And that simple hypothesis dismayed her, because it permitted her to realize the extreme of unhappiness she had reached. Then she summoned her last strength and obliged her husband to talk to her without evasion, to confront her, to argue with her, to cry with her in rage at the loss of paradise, until they heard the last rooster crow and the light filtered in through the lace curtains of the palace, and the sun rose, and her husband, puffy with so much talk, exhausted with lack of sleep, his heart fortified with so much weeping, laced his shoes, tightened his belt, fastened everything that remained to him of his manhood, and told her, "Yes, my love." They were going to look for the love they had lost in Europe, starting tomorrow and forever after. It was such a firm decision that he arranged with the Treasury Bank, his general administrator, for the immediate liquidation of the vast family fortune, which was dispersed and had been from the very beginning, in all kinds of businesses, investments, and long-term sacred bonds, and which only he knew was not as excessive as legend would have it. Just large enough so one did not need to think about it. What there was of it was converted into stamped gold, to be invested little by little in his foreign bank accounts, until he and his wife would own nothing in this harsh country, not even a plot of ground to die on. And yet Florentino Arisa actually existed, contrary to what she had decided to believe. He was on the pier where the French ocean liner was docked when she arrived with her husband and child in the landau drawn by the golden horses, and he saw them emerge as he had so often seen them at public ceremonies. Perfect. They were leaving with their son, raised in such a way that one could already see what he would be like as an adult. And so he was. Juvenal Urbino greeted Florentino Arisa with a joyous wave of his hat. "We're off to conquer Flanders." Fermina Daza nodded, and Florentino Arisa took off his hat and made a slight bow, and she looked at him without the slightest compassion for the premature ravages of baldness. There he was, just as she saw him, the shadow of someone she had never met. These were not the best times for Florentino Arisa, either. In addition to his work, which grew more and more intense, and the tedium of his furtive hunting and the dead calm of the years, there was also the final crisis of Tránsito Arisa, whose mind had been left almost without memories, almost a blank, to the point where she would turn to him at times, see him reading in the armchair he always sat in, and ask him, in surprise, "And whose son are you?" He would always reply with the truth, but she would interrupt him again without delay. "And tell me something, my boy," she would ask. "Who am I?" She had grown so fat that she could not move, and she spent the day in the notion shop, where there was no longer anything to sell, primping and dressing in finery from the time she awoke with the first roosters until the following dawn, for she slept very little. She would put garlands of flowers on her head, paint her lips, powder her face and arms, and at last she would ask whoever was with her, "Who am I now?" The neighbors knew that she always expected the same reply. "You are little Rochi Martinez." This identity, stolen from a character in a children's story, was the only one that satisfied her. She continued to rock and to fan herself with long pink feathers until she began all over again. The crown of paper flowers, violet on her eyelids, red on her lips, dead white on her face. And again the question to whoever was nearby, "Who am I now?" When she became the laughingstock of the neighborhood, Florentino Arisa had the counter and the storage drawers of the old notion shop dismantled in one night and the street door sealed and the space arranged just as he had heard it describe Rochi Martinez's bedroom. And she never asked again who she was. At the suggestion of Uncle Leo XII, he found an older woman to take care of her, but the poor thing was always more asleep than awake, and at times she gave the impression that she too forgot who she was. So that Florentino Arisa would stay home from the time he left the office until he managed to put his mother to sleep. He no longer played dominoes at the commercial club, and for a long time he did not visit the few women friends he had continued to see, for something very profound had changed in his heart after his dreadful meeting with Olimpia Zuleta. It was as if he had been struck by lightning. Florentino Arisa had just taken Uncle Leo XII home during one of those October storms that would leave us reeling, when he saw from his carriage a slight, very agile girl in a dress covered with organza ruffles that looked like a bridal gown. He saw her running in alarm from one side of the street to the other, because the wind had snatched away her parasol and was blowing it out to sea. He rescued her in his carriage and went out of his way to take her to a house, an old converted hermitage that faced the open sea and whose patio, visible from the street, was full of pigeon coops. On the way, She told him that she had been married less than a year to a man who sold trinkets in the market, whom Florentino Arisa had often seen on his company's boats, unloading cartons of all kinds of saleable merchandise, and with a multitude of pigeons in a wicker cage of the sort mothers used on riverboats for carrying infants. Olimpia Zuleta seemed to belong to the wasp family, not only because of her high buttocks and meager bosom, but because of everything about her. Her hair, like copper wire, her freckles, her round animated eyes that were farther apart than normal, and her melodious voice that she used only for saying intelligent and amusing things. Florentino Arisa thought she was more witty than attractive, and he forgot her as soon as he left her at her house, where she lived with her husband, his father, and other members of his family. A few days later, he saw her husband at the port, loading merchandise instead of unloading it, and when the ship weighed anchor, Florentino heard, with great clarity, the voice of the devil in his ear. That afternoon, after taking Uncle Leo XII home, he passed by Olimpia Zuleta's house as if by accident, and he saw her over the fence feeding the noisy pigeons. He called to her from his carriage, "How much for a pigeon?" She recognized him and answered in a merry voice, "They are not for sale." He asked, "Then what must I do to get one?" Still feeding the pigeons, she replied, "You drive her back to the coop when you find her lost in a storm." So that Florentino Arisa arrived home that night with a thank you gift from Olimpia Zuleta, a carrier pigeon with a metal ring around its leg. The next afternoon, just at dinner time, the beautiful pigeon fancier saw the gift carrier pigeon in the dovecote and thought it had escaped. But when she picked it up to examine it, she realized that there was a slip of paper inside the ring, a declaration of love. It was the first time that Florentino Arisa had left a written trace, and it would not be the last, although on this occasion he had been prudent enough not to sign his name. He was going into his house the following afternoon, a Wednesday, when a street boy handed him the same pigeon in a cage with a memorized message that "the pigeon lady hereby sends you this, and says to tell you to please keep the cage locked, because if not, it will fly away again, and this is the last time she will send it back." He had no idea how to interpret this. Either the pigeon had lost the note en route, or the pigeon keeper had decided to play innocent, or she had returned the pigeon so that he could send it back to her again. If that was true, however, the natural thing would have been for her to return the pigeon with a reply. On Saturday morning, after much thought, Florentino Arisa sent back the pigeon with another unsigned letter. This time, he did not have to wait until the next day. In the afternoon, the same boy brought it back in another cage, with a message that said she hereby sends back the pigeon that flew away again, and that the day before yesterday she returned it out of courtesy, and this time she returns it out of pity, but that now it is really true that she will not return it again if it flies away another time. Tránsito Arisa played with the pigeon until very late. She took it out of the cage. She rocked it in her arms. She tried to lull it to sleep with children's songs. And then suddenly, Florentino Arisa realized that in the ring around its leg was a little piece of paper with one line written on it: "I do not accept anonymous letters." Florentino Arisa read it, his heart wild with joy as if this were the culmination of his first adventure, and he did not sleep a wink that night as he tossed and turned with impatience. Very early the next day, before he left for the office, he once again set the pigeon free, carrying a love note that bore his clear signature, and he also put in the ring the freshest, reddest, and most fragrant rose from his garden. It was not that easy. After 3 months of pursuit, the beautiful pigeon fancier was still sending the same answer: "I am not one of those women." But she never refused to accept his messages, or broke any of the dates that Florentino Arisa arranged so that they would seem to be casual encounters. He was a different person. The lover who never showed his face, the man most avid for love as well as most niggardly with it, the man who gave nothing and wanted everything, the man who did not allow anyone to leave a trace of her passing in his heart, the hunter lying in ambush. This man went out on the street in the midst of ecstatic signed letters, gallant gifts, imprudent vigils at the pigeon keeper's house, even on two occasions when her husband was not on a trip or at the market. It was the only time since his youngest days when he felt himself run through by the lance of love. 6 months after their first meeting, they found themselves at last in a cabin on a riverboat that was being painted at the docks. It was a marvelous afternoon. Olimpia Zuleta had the joyous love of a startled pigeon fancier, and she preferred to remain naked for several hours in a slow-moving repose that was, for her, as loving as love itself. The cabin was dismantled, half-painted, and they would take the odor of turpentine away with them in the memory of a happy afternoon. In a sudden inspiration, Florentino Ariza opened a can of red paint that was in reach of the bunk, wet his index finger, and painted the pubis of the beautiful pigeon fancier with an arrow of blood pointing south, and on her belly the words, "This pussy is mine." That same night, Olimpia Zuleta undressed in front of her husband, having forgotten what was scrawled there, and he did not say a word. His breathing did not even change. Nothing. But he went to the bathroom for his razor while she was putting on her nightgown, and in a single slash, he cut her throat. Florentino did not find out until many days later, when the fugitive husband was captured and told the newspapers the reasons for the crime and how he had committed it. For many years, he thought with terror about the signed letters. He kept track of the prison term of the murderer, who knew him because of his dealings with the boat company. But it was not so much fear of a knife at his throat or a public scandal as the misfortune of Fermina Daza's learning about his infidelity. One day during his years of waiting, the woman who took care of Tránsito Ariza had to stay at the market longer than expected because of an unseasonable downpour. And when she returned to the house, she found her sitting in the rocking chair, painted and bedecked as always, and with eyes so animated and a smile so mischievous that her caretaker did not realize she was dead until 2 hours later. Shortly before her death, she had distributed to the neighborhood children the fortune in gold and jewels hidden in the jars buried under her bed, saying they could eat them like candy, and some of the most valuable were impossible to recover. Florentino Ariza buried her in the former Hand of God Ranch, which was still known as the Cholera Cemetery, and he planted a rosebush on her grave. After his first few visits to the cemetery, Florentino Ariza discovered that Olimpia Zuleta was buried very close by, without a tombstone, but with her name and the date scrawled in the fresh cement of the crypt. And he thought in horror that this was one of her husband's sanguinary jokes. When the roses bloomed, he would place a flower on her grave if there was no one in sight, and later he planted a cutting taken from his mother's rosebush. Both bloomed in such profusion that Florentino Ariza had to bring shears and other garden tools to keep them under control. But the task was beyond him. After a few years, the two rosebushes had spread like weeds among the graves, and from then on, the unadorned cemetery of the plague was called the Cemetery of Roses. Until some mayor, who was less realistic than popular wisdom, cleared out the roses one night and hung a Republican sign from the arch of the entrance gate. Universal Cemetery. The death of his mother left Florentino Ariza condemned once again to his maniacal pursuits. The office, his meetings in strict rotation with his regular mistresses, the domino games at the commercial club, the same books of love, the Sunday visits to the cemetery. It was the rust of routine, which he had despised and feared so much, but which had protected him from an awareness of his age. However, one Sunday in December, when the rose bushes on the tombs had already defeated the garden shears. He saw the swallows on the recently installed electric wires, and he suddenly realized how much time had gone by since the death of his mother, and how much since the murder of Olympia Suletta, and how very much since that other distant December afternoon when Fermina Vassa sent him a letter saying, yes, she would love him always. Until then, he had behaved as if time would not pass for him, but only for others. Just the week before, he happened to meet on the street one of the many couples who had married because of the letters he had written, and he did not recognize their oldest child, who was his godson. He smoothed over his embarrassment with the conventional exclamation, "I'll be damned. He's a man already." And he continued in the same way, even after his body began sending him the first warning signals, because he had always had the iron constitution of the sickly. Tránsito Arisa used to say, "The only disease my son ever had was cholera." She had confused cholera with love, of course, long before her memory failed. But in any event, she was mistaken, because her son had suffered from 6 blennorrhagias, although the doctor had said they were not 6, but the same one that reappeared after each lost battle. He had also had a swollen lymph gland, 4 warts, and 6 cases of impetigo in the groin. But it would not have occurred to him or any man to think of these as diseases. They were only the spoils of war. When he had just turned 40, he had gone to the doctor because of vague pains in various parts of his body. After many tests, the doctor had said, "It's age." He had returned home without even wondering if any of that had anything to do with him. For his only point of reference in his own past was the ephemeral love affair with Fermina Vassa, and only what concerned her had anything to do with reckoning his life. So that on the afternoon when he saw the swallows on the electric wires, he reviewed the past from his earliest memory. He reviewed his chance loves, the countless pitfalls he had been obliged to avoid in order to reach a position of authority, the events without number that had given rise to his bitter determination that Fermina Vassa would be his and he would be hers, despite everything, in the face of everything. And only then did he realize that his life was passing. He was shaken by a visceral shudder that left his mind blank, and he had to drop the garden tools and lean against the cemetery wall so that the first blow of old age would not knock him down. "Damn it," he said, appalled. "That all happened 30 years ago." And it had. 30 years that had also gone by for Fermina Vassa, of course, but had been for her the most pleasant and exhilarating years of her life. The days of horror in the palace of Casalduero were relegated to the trash heap of memory. She was living in her new house in La Manga, absolute mistress of her own destiny, with a husband she would have preferred to all the men in the world if she had to choose again, a son who was continuing the family tradition in the medical school, and a daughter so much like her when she was her age that at times she was disturbed by the impression of feeling herself duplicated. She had returned to Europe 3 times after the unfortunate trip from which she had intended never to return, so that she would not have to live in perpetual turmoil. God must have finally listened to someone's prayers. After 2 years in Paris, when Fermina Vassa and Juvenal Urbino were just beginning to find what remained of their love in the ruins, a midnight telegram awoke them with the news that Doña Blanca de Urbino was gravely ill, and almost on its heels came another with the news of her death. They returned without delay. Fermina Vassa walked off the ship wearing a black tunic whose fullness could not hide her condition. In fact, she was pregnant again. And this news gave rise to a popular song, more mischievous than malicious, whose chorus was heard for the rest of the year. "What do you think she does over there, this beauty from our earth? Whenever she comes back from Paris, she's ready to give birth." Despite the vulgarity of the words, For many years afterward, Dr. Juvenal Urbino would request it at social club dances to prove he was a good sport. The noble palace of the Marquis de Casalduero, whose existence and coat of arms had never been documented, was sold to the municipal treasury for a decent price and then resold for a fortune to the central government when a Dutch researcher began excavations to prove that the real grave of Christopher Columbus was located there, the fifth one so far. The sisters of Dr. Urbino, without taking vows, went to live in seclusion in the convent of the Salesians, and Fermina Daza stayed in her father's old house until the Via in La Manga was completed. She walked in with a firm step. She walked in prepared to command, with the English furniture brought back on their honeymoon and the complimentary furnishings they sent for after their reconciliation trip, and from the first day, she began to fill it with exotic animals that she herself went to buy on the schooners from the Antilles. She walked in with the husband she had won back, the son she had raised with propriety, the daughter who was born 4 months after their return, and whom they baptized Ophelia. Dr. Urbino, for his part, understood that it was impossible to possess his wife as completely as he had on their honeymoon, because the part of love he wanted was what she had given, along with her best hours, to her children. But he learned to live and be happy with what was left over. The harmony they had longed for reached its culmination when they least expected it, at a gala dinner at which a delicious food was served that Fermina Daza could not identify. She began with a good portion, but she liked it so much that she took another of the same size, and she was lamenting the fact that urbane etiquette did not permit her to help herself to a third when she learned that she had just eaten, with unsuspected pleasure, 2 heaping plates of pureed eggplant. She accepted defeat with good grace, and from that time on, eggplant in all its forms was served at the Villa in La Manga with almost as much frequency as at the palace of Casalduero, and it was enjoyed so much by everyone that Dr. Juvenal Urbino would lighten the idle hours of his old age by insisting that he wanted to have another daughter so that he could give her the best-loved word in the house as a name, Eggplant Urbino. Fermina Daza knew then that private life, unlike public life, was fickle and unpredictable. It was not easy for her to establish real differences between children and adults, but in the last analysis, she preferred children, because their judgment was more reliable. She had barely turned the corner into maturity, free at last of illusions, when she began to detect the disillusionment of never having been what she had dreamed of being when she was young, in the Park of the Evangels. Instead, she was something she never dared admit even to herself, a deluxe servant. In society, she came to be the woman most loved, most catered to, and by the same token, most feared, but in nothing was she more demanding or less forgiving than in the management of her house. She always felt as if her life had been lent to her by her husband. She was absolute monarch of a vast empire of happiness, which had been built by him and for him alone. She knew that he loved her above all else, more than anyone else in the world, but only for his own sake. She was in his holy service. If anything vexed her, it was the perpetual chain of daily meals, for they not only had to be served on time, they had to be perfect, and they had to be just what he wanted to eat without his having to be asked. If she ever did ask, in one of the innumerable useless ceremonies of their domestic ritual, he would not even look up from the newspaper and would reply, "Anything." In his amiable way, he was telling the truth, because one could not imagine a less despotic husband. But when it was time to eat, it could not be anything, but just what he wanted, and with no defects. The meat should not taste of meat, and the fish should not taste of fish, and the pork should not taste of mange, and the chicken should not taste of feathers. Even when it was not the season for asparagus, it had to be found, regardless of cost, so that he could take pleasure in the vapors of his own fragrant urine. She did not blame him. She blamed life. But he was an implacable protagonist in that life. At the mere hint of a doubt, he would push aside his plate and say, "This meal has been prepared without love." In that sphere, he would achieve moments of fantastic inspiration. Once, he tasted some chamomile tea and sent it back, saying only, "This stuff tastes of window." Both she and the servants were surprised because they had never heard of anyone who had drunk boiled window. But when they tried the tea in an effort to understand, they understood. It did taste of window. He was a perfect husband. He never picked up anything from the floor or turned out a light or closed a door. In the morning darkness, when he found a button missing from his clothes, she would hear him say, "A man should have two wives, one to love and one to sew on his buttons." Every day at his first swallow of coffee and at his first spoonful of soup, he would break into a heart-rending howl that no longer frightened anyone and then unburden himself. "The day I leave this house, you will know it is because I grew tired of always having a burned mouth." He would say that they never prepared lunches as appetizing and unusual as on the days when he could not eat because he had taken a laxative. And he was so convinced that this was treachery on the part of his wife that in the end he refused to take a purgative unless she took one with him. Tired of his lack of understanding, she asked him for an unusual birthday gift: that for one day, he would take care of the domestic chores. He accepted in amusement, and indeed took charge of the house at dawn. He served a splendid breakfast, but he forgot that fried eggs did not agree with her, and that she did not drink café con leche. Then he ordered a birthday luncheon for 8 guests, and gave instructions for tidying the house. And he tried so hard to manage better than she did, that before noon he had to capitulate without a trace of embarrassment. From the first moment, he realized he did not have the slightest idea where anything was, above all in the kitchen. And the servants let him upset everything to find each item, for they were playing the game too. At 10 o'clock, no decisions had been made regarding lunch, because the house cleaning was not finished yet. The bedroom was not straightened, the bathroom was not scrubbed. He forgot to replace the toilet paper, change the sheets, and send the coachman for the children. And he confused the servants' duties. He told the cook to make the beds and set the chambermaids to cooking. At 11 o'clock, when the guests were about to arrive, the chaos in the house was such that Fermina Vasa resumed command, laughing out loud, not with the triumphant attitude she would have liked, but shaken instead with compassion for the domestic helplessness of her husband. He was bitter as he offered the argument he always used. "Things did not go as badly for me as they would for you if you tried to cure the sick." But it was a useful lesson, and not for him alone. Over the years, they both reached the same wise conclusion by different paths. It was not possible to live together in any other way, or love in any other way, and nothing in this world was more difficult than love. In the fullness of her new life, Fermina Vasa would see Florentino Ariza on various public occasions, with more frequency as he improved his position. But she learned to see him with so much naturalness that more than once, in sheer distraction, she forgot to greet him. She heard about him often, because in the world of business, his cautious but inexorable advance in the RCC was a constant topic of conversation. She saw him improve his manners. His timidity was passed off as a certain enigmatic distance. A slight increase in weight suited him, as did the slowness of age, and he had known how to handle his absolute baldness with dignity. The only area in which he persisted in defying time and fashion was in his somber attire, his anachronistic frock coats, his unique hat, the poet's string ties from his mother's notion shop, his sinister umbrella. Fermina Vasa grew accustomed to seeing him with other eyes, and in the end, she did not connect him to the languid adolescent who would sit and sigh for her under the gusts of yellow leaves in the Park of the Evangels. In any case, she never saw him with indifference, and she was always pleased by the good news she heard about him, because that helped to alleviate her guilt. However, when she thought he was completely erased from her memory, he reappeared where she least expected him, a phantom of her nostalgia. It was during the first glimmering of old age when she began to feel that something irreparable had occurred in her life whenever she heard thunder before the rain. It was the incurable wound of solitary, stony, punctual thunder that would sound every afternoon in October at 3 o'clock in the Sierra Villanueva, a memory that was becoming more vivid as the years went by. While more recent events blurred in just a few days, the memories of her legendary journey through Cousin Ildebranda's province were as sharp as if they had happened yesterday, and they had the perverse clarity of nostalgia. She remembered Manaure in the mountains, its one straight green street, its birds of good omen, the haunted house where she would wake to find her nightgown soaked by the endless tears of Petra Morales, who had died of love many years before in the same bed where she lay sleeping. She remembered the taste of the guavas, which had never been the same again, the warning thunder, which had been so intense that its sound was confused with the sound of rain, the topaz afternoons in San Juan del Cesar, when she would go walking with her court of excited cousins and clench her teeth so that her heart would not leap out of her mouth as they approached the telegraph office. She had to sell her father's house because she could not bear the pain of her adolescence, the view of the desolate little park from the balcony, the sibylline fragrance of gardenias on hot nights, the frightening face of an old lady on the February afternoon when her fate was decided. And regardless of where she turned her memory of those times, she would find herself face to face with Florentino Ariza. But she always had enough serenity to know that they were not memories of love or repentance, but the image of a sorrow that left a trail of tears on her cheeks. Without realizing it, she was menaced by the same trap of pity that had been the downfall of so many of Florentino Ariza's defenseless victims. She clung to her husband, and it was just at the time when he needed her most, because he suffered the disadvantage of being 10 years ahead of her as he stumbled alone through the mists of old age, with the even greater disadvantage of being a man and weaker than she was. In the end, they knew each other so well that by the time they had been married for 30 years, they were like a single divided being, and they felt uncomfortable at the frequency with which they guessed each other's thoughts without intending to, or the ridiculous accident of one of them anticipating in public what the other was going to say. Together they had overcome the daily incomprehension, the instantaneous hatred, the reciprocal nastiness and fabulous flashes of glory in the conjugal conspiracy. It was the time when they loved each other best, without hurry or excess, when both were most conscious of and grateful for their incredible victories over adversity. Life would still present them with other mortal trials, of course, but that no longer mattered. They were on the other shore. On the occasion of the celebration of the new century, there was an innovative program of public ceremonies, the most memorable of which was the first journey in a balloon, the fruit of the boundless initiative of Dr. Juvenal Urbino. Half the city gathered on the Arsenal beach to express their wonderment at the ascent of the enormous balloon made of taffeta in the colors of the flag, which carried the first airmail to San Juan de la Cienega, some 30 leagues to the northeast as the crow flies. Dr. Juvenal Urbino and his wife, who had experienced the excitement of flight at the World's Fair in Paris, were the first to climb into the wicker basket, followed by the pilot and 6 distinguished guests. They were carrying a letter from the governor of the province to the municipal officials of San Juan de la Cienega, in which it was documented for all time that this was the first mail transported through the air. A journalist from the Commercial Daily asked Dr. Juvenal Urbino for his final words in the event he perished during the adventure, and he did not even take the time to think about the answer that would earn him so much abuse. "In my opinion," he said, "the 19th century is passing for everyone except us." Lost in the guileless crowd that sang the national anthem as the balloon gained altitude, Florentino Ariza felt himself in agreement with the person whose comments he heard over the din, to the effect that this was not a suitable exploit for a woman, least of all one as old as Fermina Daza. But it was not so dangerous after all, or at least not so much dangerous as depressing. The balloon reached its destination without incident after a peaceful trip through an incredible blue sky. They flew well and very low, with a calm, favorable wind, first along the spurs of the snow-covered mountains, and then over the vastness of the great swamp. From the sky they could see, just as God saw them, the ruins of the very old and heroic city of Cartagena de Indias, the most beautiful in the world, abandoned by its inhabitants because of the cholera panic, after 3 centuries of resistance to the sieges of the English and the atrocities of the buccaneers. They saw the walls still intact, the brambles in the streets, the fortifications devoured by Heartsease, the marble palaces and the golden altars, and the viceroys rotting with plague inside their armor. They flew over the lake dwellings of the Trojas in Cataca, painted in lunatic colors, with pens holding iguanas raised for food, and balsam apples and crepe myrtle hanging in the lacustrine gardens. Excited by everyone's shouting, hundreds of naked children plunged into the water, jumping out of windows, jumping from the roofs of the houses and from the canoes that they handled with astonishing skill, and diving like shad to recover the bundles of clothing, the bottles of cough syrup, the beneficent food that the beautiful lady with the feathered hat threw to them from the basket of the balloon. They flew over the dark ocean of the banana plantations, whose silence reached them like a lethal vapor. And Fermina Daza remembered herself at the age of 3, perhaps 4, walking through the shadowy forest holding the hand of her mother, who was almost a girl herself, surrounded by other women dressed in muslin just like her mother, with white parasols and hats made of gauze. The pilot, who was observing the world through a spyglass, said, "They seem dead." He passed the spyglass to Dr. Juvenal Urbino, who saw the ox carts and the cultivated fields, the boundary lines of the railroad track,